Now in Psalm 5, and of course this subscription to the chief musician upon Nealah, the first part of Psalm 5 actually goes on the last part of Psalm 4. Now the word Nealah is the word for wind instrument. So you'd have this Psalm 4 on clarinet and wind instruments, not on strings like Psalm 3 would be. So the message of Psalm 4, the pace of it, the tenor of it is more of a type attitude or feeling that would fit the wind instruments. So when you see this word Nealah, then you need to think about that type of a move or a message or rhythm that would be more appropriate for wind instruments. Consider my meditation. Hearken to the voice of my cry, my King and my God, for unto you I'll pray. So when you pray and you feel like God just isn't hearing you, and you pray and you don't feel like your prayer's getting past the ceiling, then Psalm 4 and 5 are real appropriate to read. Because Psalm 4 isn't as doubtful as Psalm 5, you know. Psalm 5 is more, well, God, what's the matter, you know? How come you're not listening, you know? How come you're not giving your ear to my words? How come you're not hearkening, God? I'm crying, my King and my God, I'm praying to you. My voice you're going to hear in the morning. Oh, eternal, in the morning I'm going to direct my prayer to you, and I'm going to look up. So maybe a lot of times if you've got a real emotional prayer and a real moving prayer feeling, you shouldn't have your face bowed and your head on your bed, and you should in the morning lift your face up to God. And I know a lot of times when we've had baptizing tours or we've had meetings outdoors and a minister would be praying, you know, he'd have his face up to the sky and be praying up. So that's not unbiblical at all. It's right here, right in the Scriptures. That's where God is. You're talking to God up there. So in the morning, God, I'm looking up and I want you to hear my voice. Because you're not a God that has pleasure in wickedness. Neither shall evil dwell with you. Now you get a knowledge of God in the Psalms that God is of too holy a nature to regard iniquity. You know, when people begin to go astray, God just turns away. God turns his face and turns his back. God doesn't just stand there and look down on you while you're going in your way of wickedness. Because God doesn't take any pleasure in standing there looking down and seeing someone go in the way of wickedness. God is too pure a God to regard iniquity. You're not a God that has pleasure in wickedness. Neither shall evil dwell with you. Now that's a good verse just to mark God on. That's the way God is. It shows you God's nature. So, when you bear sin, you're cut off from God. And that's what Christ meant when he said, when he took man's sin on him and died, he said, my God, why have you forsaken me? And for that instant, God did turn away. Verse 5, the foolish shall not stand. Either when Christ comes back, they're going to run and hide in the rocks and the caves, but they don't even stand from day to day and month to month either. The foolish shall not stand in God's sight. God hates all workers of iniquity. Boy, that's bad. God hates? I mean, that's surely not. God can't be a God that hates. Well, God does hate workers of iniquity because he knows what it does to them and what it does to others. He doesn't hate the individual because he's doing it, but he hates what it's doing to the individual and what it's doing to other people. So God does hate all workers of iniquity. You shall destroy them that speak lies and deceit. There's the word leasing again. The Eternal will abhor the bloody and deceitful man. So, you know, God doesn't love you in your sins. God turns away from people in their sins. God can't stand to look at bloody, deceitful men. God abhors bloody and deceitful men. God hates all workers of iniquity. Well, maybe the more you're in God's church and the more you grow spiritually, the more you feel that way too. You know, it talks about Lot and says his just soul was vexed by the wickedness of those all about him all the time. You know, Jesus said, he that hates his life in this world. So if you have times when you just hate life in this world, well, you know, Jesus said, that's not a bad sign, that's good. Well, then David went on to say, but as for me, I'll come into your house in the multitude of your mercy. So he knew he didn't come into God's house with his own confidence or his own righteousness or his own goodness. And that's bad, you know. They're one of the worst things in the Bible is to be haughty and self-righteous and high-minded and superior. You know, the wisest man who ever lived, Solomon, said, "There is a generation, how haughty and how high are their eyes, and they say, 'I'm holier than you, don't come near me.'" But notice David's attitude. When David came into God's house, it was always with the attitude of grace. In the multitude of God's mercy, that's always the way David came into God's house. "And in your fear," he didn't know when God might just finally decide he'd had enough of him, and "in your fear, I'll worship toward your holy place, toward the temple of your holiness. Lead me, O Eternal, in your righteousness, because of mine enemies. Make your way straight before my face. For there is no faithfulness in their mouth. Their inward part is utterly wickedness. Their throat's an open sepulcher. They flatter with their tongue. Destroy you them, O God. Let them fall by their own counsels. Cast them out in the multitude of their transgressions. For they've rebelled against you." Now, the series all of a sudden beginning to get a little bit worked up at the enemy and the... "Let all those that put their trust in you rejoice. Let them ever shout for joy, because you defend them. Let them also that love your name be joyful in you. For you, Eternal, you'll bless the righteous. With favor you'll compass him about as with a shield." Now, you might notice down in Psalm 6, "To the chief musician on Niganoth upon Shemaniah." So here now, all of a sudden, you've got two different terms. Niganoth, we've read already. That's the same as Psalm 3. A stringed type atmosphere or movement or melody or message in the words. And yet, Shemaniah means an octave lower. So it's not the soprano violins, or it's more the cello and the bass and the lower, octave lower strings that would give a... You know, when I hear Mr. Neff play the bass, I think about Psalm 5, because it has that kind of a low, masculine kind of a blues-type number in a way, and yet it's a stringed number. Now, in Psalm 6, here's another Psalm of David. "O Eternal, rebuke me not in your anger, neither chasten me in your hot displeasure." And I don't know how many times I've talked to people where they decided they'd come to the stage in Christian living that they just really wanted to grow in leaps and bounds, so they just cried out to God to chasten them and correct them and chastise them and discipline them. They forgot to say in limits, you know. They forgot to, and they found out in a hurry they'd made a mistake, you know. And then all of a sudden they cry out, "Well, wait, God, hold off, wait a minute. I guess it wasn't quite as strong as I thought it was now, so let me have a little more time." And, you know, so that's what David is saying here. He knows you have to be rebuked and corrected, but boy, you know, don't let God let it all out on you at once. "O Eternal, rebuke me not in your anger, neither chasten me in your hot displeasure." So apparently he knew there's a time when God really gets worked up, and God can really rebuke you in anger and chasten you in hot displeasure. Now, of course, if you're not strong enough as a human, you can't always realize it's for your good, and if you're not strong enough to take it, it might not be for your good. So then all of a sudden he said, "Have mercy." Boy, the next thing. "Have mercy on me, O Eternal, because I'm weak. I'm not as strong as I thought I was, God. I just got braggart and got kind of big mouth, and I'm sorry about that, you know. Have mercy. I'm weak. O Eternal, heal me, for my bones are vexed. My soul is also sore vexed." Now, you wouldn't think a soul could be bothered, would you, if it's an immortal essence within you, but David's soul got sore vexed. "But you, O Eternal, how long?" Now, this is one of the many, many, many how long. And, you know, you had that happen in your life many a time, where you cry out to God, you beseech God, and God doesn't intervene right away, and you say, "How long? How long?" So those you'll want to mark as you go through. "Return, O Eternal, deliver my soul. Oh, save me for your mercy's sake." So that's a real lesson to learn. Don't just ask God to chasten you, except in measure. and to rebuke you except in measure, because we're not that strong. For in death there's no remembrance of you. Now God, if you just don't heal me and you rebuke me and chasten me this way, why, if I'm dead, I can't remember you and praise you. And in the grave, who will give you thanks? Now that's another good word too, another good verse for the soul or hell. Because when you go to the grave, you don't go to heaven and give God thanks. When you go to the grave, you're just temporarily out of circulation, period. The dead know not anything. So, I'm weary with my groaning. All the night I make my bed to swim. I water my couch with my tears. So this is one of the real prayers when you've had a real trial and God hadn't intervened and you've cried out to God and God hadn't answered. And this is a good psalm to remember. You can water your bed with your tears. You can make your bed to swim. Mine eye is consumed because of grief. It waxes old because of all mine enemies. Depart from me, all you workers of iniquity, for the Eternal has heard the voice of my weeping. The Eternal has heard my supplication. Now here again, if you've never checked the difference between the word supplication and prayer, you need to note when we go through the Bible, the word supplication is not just a synonym for prayer. The word supplication is the strongest type of prayer that exists. The word supplication means habitual beseeching God about one particular thing every day. And in a lot of cases, it's even connected with fasting. So whatever, you know, it's used about overcoming strong faults of human nature. It's used in real trials of testings and discouragement. But supplication means habitual, daily, beseeching of God about one particular thing. So here the Eternal has heard my supplication. The Eternal will receive my prayer. Now he's not just double talking there for poetic purposes. He's talking about a couple of total different things. Let all mine enemies be ashamed and sore vexed. Let them return and be ashamed suddenly. So, you know, if you want to learn some psalms by content, this one you can remember. Chastening in measure. How long, O Lord? And supplication. And then you can come back and use that one appropriately when the need is there. Now, the first part of Psalm 7 actually fits on the last part of Psalm 6, where it says, Shigion of David, literally meaning a turbulent lyric. Now, the next psalm is about another time in history. If you want to turn back and read the historical setting of what's going on here, and then fit this story in with it, back in Samuel. I think we'll go ahead and quit there rather than reading Psalm 7, because I don't want to keep you late just because we got started a little late. Okay, there are two or three things we want to introduce this evening before we jump right back in going through the Psalms one by one. There's one type of writing in the Scriptures that we might call in plain English beans and cornbread languages, they say. Alphabetical Scriptures are, in the more scholarly terminology, what they call acrostic, A-C-R-O-S-T-I-C. Of course, Psalm 119 is the most famous, the most obvious one, because even in your King James translation, it divides up Psalm 119 into groups of 8 verses and alphabetizes those according to the Hebrew alphabet. So if you want to recognize or learn the Hebrew alphabet, you can do that even in the King James translation of Psalm 119. Now what it doesn't show in the King James translation, if you were to read these verses in the Hebrew, not only would you find Aleph as a summary of the 8 verses, but you'd find each one of the statements beginning with the Hebrew letter Aleph. So verse 1 would begin with the word that started with Aleph, 2, 3, 4, 5, on down through 8. And then the same way with the next 8, with the second letter, Beth, Gimel, Daleth, right on down through the Hebrew alphabet.
So if you've got eight verses for each of the 22 letters, then you'll come out with 176 verses in the chapter, which of course you do. Now there are several other similar alphabetized parts of the Bible. Proverbs 31, we've mentioned a number of times. The last 22 verses that deal with the strong Christian woman are all alphabetized. So beginning with verse 10, if you read this in the Hebrew language, the statement in verse 10 would begin with Aleph, Beth, Gimel, Daleth, right on down through 22 letters. And of course, you'd come out with the 31 verses then. Now, of course, the question comes then, why would God alphabetize certain parts of the Bible? Of course, when you see what parts are alphabetized, it becomes quite obvious why he did that. For ease and memory, for setting the music, for being able to learn and recall to memory. Now, some books may be rather a shock that God alphabetized them as well. You might notice the book of Lamentations. You might think, well, that's certainly not a poetic book. It certainly is written by Jeremiah as he saw what God had prophesied was going to happen, and he was left there in the land to see it happen and record it in this lamentation. So, in a sense, you can set yourself in the days of the coming captivity of Israel and picture what it's going to be like by lamenting with Jeremiah what he witnessed in his day and lamented. So God considered what he had Jeremiah have to endure worthy of being alphabetized, just like other parts of the Bible. So you might notice the first chapter of Lamentations, 22 verses. The second chapter has 22 verses. Of course, the third chapter has 66 verses. So you have three verses under each Hebrew letter. Or each of those statements would begin with the Hebrew letter Aleph. So 1, 2, and 3 all begin with Aleph. 4, 5, and 6 with Beth, and right on down through the Hebrew alphabet. Then in chapter 4, you notice there are exactly 22 verses. And then again in chapter 5, you have 22 verses. Now, some parts of the Bible aren't that perfect in the alphabetizing of it. There are a number of psalms that are alphabetized. Some of those we'll cover this evening. So we wanted to at least introduce you to that. In some cases, you can put two chapters together, like Psalm 9 and 10. And yet, it isn't a perfect acrostic. You wouldn't find the exact A, B, C right down the line in Psalm 9 and 10, as you found in some of these other alphabetized parts of the Bible. Same thing in Psalm 25, but we'll come to those as we come to them. Now, in wondering why a psalm wouldn't come out exactly alphabetized like Psalm 9 and 10 when you put them together, there are a lot of ideas about why it didn't come out exactly perfectly alphabetized. Some letters of the Hebrew alphabet are left out, and a few are even repeated. So there's, you know, one man might say, because it pictures the time of the tribulation and all the terror and trouble that's going to come on man, so some of the letters weren't used, and some were used again to emphasize the trouble that's coming, the confusion. Now, whether that's the answer or not, you know, we don't always have all of the answers. We might have an answer, or we might have a thought or an explanation, and then maybe later on God might show you the answer. But until he does, you just have to consider it and think about it. I saw a sermon title this past week. One of the ministers sent in on his monthly report I'd like to have heard the sermon because the title was really unique. He said, "Gray is beautiful." Now, it makes you wonder, I wonder what he preached about. But I think I know what he preached about because everybody wants everything black and white, you know. You want an absolute answer. You want everything, you know, everybody wants a Talmud. You know, everybody wants everything spelled out. So I thought, now that's a good title. Gray is beautiful. Because if everything was black and white, how much discernment, how much wisdom would you develop? You know, how much of your brain power would you use? You know, a lot of times it's fun to speculate. You know, someone asked Dr. Hay about some of the things he gave in the refresher program and said, well, Dr. Hay, how would you class those things you've given us today when he had a four-hour session? And he said, well, everything I said today you'll find in three categories. First is prophecy. Second is speculation. And third is watching. And then someone said, well, which one of those would you say that most of what you had to give today was? And he said, well, probably watching. So gray is beautiful. You know, it gives you time to kind of use your brain and wonder and think. So I don't know why Psalm 9 and 10 aren't alphabetically perfect, but I know others are, and I know God had a reason. When you notice the parts of the Bible that he had alphabetized, it really makes it emphatic. It's very important. So God himself marks parts of the Bible as ones you want to memorize. The little word Selah emphasizes parts of the Bible. We're going to run across a few other Hebrew words define certain passages as golden scriptures, golden passages, which means they're worth repeating, they're worth memorizing, they're worth learning. Now, there's another comment I might make, and that is, for some who haven't noticed or checked out the different words for sin as they go through the Bible, we've been pointing those out in prophecy, and we also will run across those many times in the book of Psalms. So maybe it's wise to just give you these words, and then you can note the particular one as we go through as to which word it is. Perhaps the most common word is the Hebrew word chata, C-H-A-T-A, which generally means to miss the mark, to stumble or fall, morally coming short. So it can be an act, a word, or a deed, but it isn't a condition. It's something you didn't live up to. So that's a very common word, to miss the mark. Now, another word is hasham, which literally means trespass. And yet, it generally means one done in ignorance. You broke a law, but you didn't know it. You stepped across a line God had drawn, and yet you weren't aware of it. So it's sinning through error or ignorance, but it literally means stepping across a border. You know, you've gone hunting, and after you came out of the property on the other side, you saw the sign that said, no trespassing. Well, you didn't know that when you went in on the backside, but you found it out when you came out on the front side. So you'd be guilty of hasham, trespassing, but you did it through ignorance. Now, another word that is used more of the nature of man, the vanity of human nature, Hebrew word is haven, H-A-V-E-N, which means, it's also the word used for idols, their vanity, their nothing. But that's the nature of man. So when you think about the Ten Commandments, doing what you're not supposed to do, and not doing what you're supposed to do, and being what you're not supposed to be. You know, there are a lot of different kinds of sin. And these words actually make you realize how many different ways people can sin. Now, one of the worst words for sin is the word haven, A-V-O-N, that literally means perverseness, from a root word to be bent or crooked. Now, that's about the worst word there can be. When you've missed the mark or trespassed, when you've allowed your human nature to get worse and worse and worse, you get down to the bottom of the barrel, and that's what this word means. You've become so bent or so crooked, so perverse, your chances are less and less of ever making it out of that condition, overcoming and being in God's kingdom. Now, another word is the word havel, A-V-A-L, that literally means unjust, unfair. So if you're dishonest or if you're deceitful, this is the word that would be used, translated unrighteous in some cases, unjust in others. Now, the word that's generally translated transgress is another different Hebrew word, haber, A-B-A-R, that means to pass beyond. Now, a word we've run over many, many times is translated evil. In many cases, it's translated wicked. And in the millennium, at least, we're going to have a consistent Bible. You know, you're going to know what word is used in each case because it'll be consistently translated. But if you look up the wicked in the King James, one time it's this word, another time it's another word, another time it's another word. So it's never consistent. But this word, rea, means evil or wicked, and that's one of the worst words of sin. The root literally comes from the nature of breaking up all that's good or desirable. So it's right along with the word aven, one of the worst words for sin. You've gone that far where you've become wicked. You know, God is angry with the wicked every day. And most of the people who've been obliterated, like Sodom and Gomorrah, well, it's because of their wickedness, not just because of missing the mark or because of trespassing in ignorance or transgressing, but it was because they'd become evil and wicked right at their root. Now, another word that's translated rebellion, it's translated revolting, is the Hebrew word Pasha, P-A-S-H-A. So when you get rebellious by nature, that's one of the worst words for sin as well. It's a habit you get into. It's a defiant, independent nature you develop. And those are most of the words we'll run into. And if we run across a few other words, we'll mention those as we touch on them. But those are primarily the words. And if you notice the times in the Bible when God poured out special vengeance, you're going to find it was because of people's abominations, because of their wickedness or their rebellion, and not just because of their sin in the simplest form of the word. Now, maybe I should touch on one other thing that we mentioned last time that several had mentioned that they hadn't fully understood. You might notice back in Isaiah 38... in those days, Hezekiah was sick unto death. Isaiah the prophet came to him. Thus says the Eternal, set your house in order. You're going to die and not live. So Hezekiah turned his face toward the wall and prayed unto the Eternal. Remember now, O Eternal, I beseech you, I have walked before you in truth with a perfect heart, done good in your sight. Hezekiah wept sore. The word of the Eternal came to Isaiah, go say to Hezekiah, I've heard your prayer and I've seen your tears. I'm going to add to your days 15 years. I'll deliver you in this city out of the hand of the king of Assyria as a sign that he'll do this. I'll bring again the shadow of the degrees, going back in the sundial, 10 degrees. Now, in remembrance of this, or as a respect and an honor of what God did, Hezekiah composed what you read here beginning in verse 9. Now, here it says, the writing. The Hebrew word writing is miktab, M-I-C-H-T-A-B, which is also translated in the Psalms, miktam, M-I-C-H-T-A-M. So some of the psalms are actually a parallel with what Hezekiah did here. As a golden remembrance of what God had done for him, Hezekiah composed this miktam. So you notice, God puts this at the top of the psalm, or the top of the writing. It's the superscription that comes at the top. And that's common to most psalms. Then you might read what he has to say there. The miktam of Hezekiah when he'd been sick and was recovered of his sickness. So he writes this memorial of God. Verse 18, the grave can't praise you. Death can't celebrate you. They that go down into the pit can't hope for your truth. The living, he shall praise you, as I do this day. So he wrote this proverb of praise, or this golden memorial to the God who delivered him and added these years. The living, he'll praise you, as I do praise you this day. The Father to the children shall make known your truth. The Eternal is ready to save me. Therefore, we will sing my songs to the stringed instruments. So here you see, at the bottom of the writing, Hezekiah tells the type of melody or the type of meaning the words have. It's a song that he wrote to be used for stringed instruments. Therefore, we'll sing my songs to the stringed instruments all the days of our life in the house of the Eternal. Now, we also noticed last time, back in the book of Habakkuk, the same type of analysis or superscription and subscription. After Micah, Nahum, Habakkuk, chapter 3. Here again, it's not actually a chapter, but it's a prayer of Habakkuk the prophet upon Shigionoth, same as you find in Psalm 7. Upon Shigionoth, O Eternal, I've heard your speech, was afraid. O Eternal, revive your work in the midst of the years. So what you find here in Habakkuk 3 is actually a prayer of moving, loud, emotional feeling of the blues, of agony and despair over what God had told him was going to happen in the last days, and then as a beseeching, wailing prayer of agony and concern, God had Habakkuk, the prophet, compose this blues prayer, and then at the end of the song, he tells him that here's the way it's to be handled, to the chief singer, on my stringed instruments. Of course, here the Hebrew word is niganoth, as you find in some of the Psalms, which literally means this is written as a sober, sad, melancholy, quiet number in the sense of what was happening, and yet an agonizing, emotional type number. So it's written for stringed instruments with that type of an attitude or atmosphere. So it's showing the smitings of the person composing the number. So the two examples outside of the book of Psalms of setting apart either a prayer or a song is to introduce it with a statement at the beginning of it, and then to conclude it as to whom it's addressed and the type of melody or the type of music that's to accompany it. Now, in the writing of the Psalms, anyway, when they wrote the Psalms in the lines here, you know, you didn't have Psalm 4, verse 1 and 2 and 3 like that. So you just had the writing, and then you had the next Psalm down here, and then the next Psalm down here. Now, of course, in between, they just put these statements. So how do you know whether they go up this way or whether they go down that way? So the only way you can tell is to look at Habakkuk and Isaiah, and then you know when it says the Psalm of David, it goes down this way. That's the lower part. And when it says the others, then it goes, it's actually the subscription on the previous psalm. And then the lower part is the superscription on the following psalm. So we'll notice those as we go through. We might back up and I'll give you those on the psalms we've covered so far. Of course, we looked and saw that Psalm 2, although it doesn't have an author, at least as a superscription, we read in the New Testament that it's attributed to David. Now, Psalm 1 and 2 are actually together. Psalm 1 starts out, "Blessed is the man." Psalm 2 ends, "Blessed are all they." So they actually are two introductory psalms that fit together. One showing the two ways of man, going the right way or going the wrong way. And then a prophecy psalm about the end time and the heathen raging and God intervening and setting up His kingdom anyway. Then with Psalm 3, you have a Psalm of David. So that's a superscription describing in what's going on in Psalm 3. Now, those titles have not been added by translators like other chapters have in the King James Version. Like Psalm 1 has happiness of the godly, misery of the wicked. That's a man's summary of what he thinks that psalm covers. Psalm 2, that's those scholars' ideas about what Psalm 2 contains. But when you get to Psalm 3, you notice they have man's title at the top, security of God's protection. But then underneath, they have a writing that's inspired. In fact, in the Hebrew text, it's actually a part of the first verse. It's not separated like that. It's a part of the verse. And it's also quoted as scripture in other parts of the Bible. So you know it was there. It wasn't added by translators either in 1611 or any other time. So Psalm 3, just like it is in your King James, a Psalm of David, when he fled from Absalom, his son. Now when you notice Psalm 4, though, "To the chief musician on Neginoth," should go at the end of Psalm 3, just like Habakkuk and like Isaiah. That's a direction to the chief musician as to the mood and the melody and the type of music that is best suited to fit the mood of the man that wrote it. So you'd have that subscription on Psalm 3, "To the chief musician on Neginoth." That is a blues type message, just like we read back there in Habakkuk. Now, a Psalm of David, that goes on Psalm 4. But when you get to Psalm 5, "To the chief musician on Neginoth," upon Shemini, that's actually the last part of Psalm 5. And then Psalm 6 would start off a Psalm of David. Now, we'll note those as we go through. Okay, let's go ahead and come on to Psalm 7. Here you find Shigion of David, which we read already back in Habakkuk 3, which means a loud cry of blues, or if you want to just put a modern term, Psalm 7 is a blues. Because you notice what's happening. The words of Cush the Benjamite. That man's never mentioned anywhere else in the Bible. But the fact that he's shown to be a Benjamite shows that he would be one of Saul's officers or one of Saul's key men that's been given the assignment of pursuing David. So David wrote this blues message, a loud cry in danger. Many places, this root word, sheag, is rendered roar. And interestingly enough, it occurs 21 times, which is perfect numerically. Okay, going on through then. "O Eternal, my God, in You do I put my trust." Now here again you find a watered-down translation. Actually, the word "put my trust" is a lot better, stronger translated, "flee for refuge." You know, think how much stronger that is. Eternal my God, in you do I flee for refuge. Not just put my trust. Save me from all them that persecute me, pursuing me, which this Cush the Benjamite was doing. Lest he tear my soul. That's a good verse for soul. You know, souls are something that can be torn. Like a lion tearing a wildebeest or a hart or a roebuck. So just like a lion would tear into an animal and with its power tear it in pieces, that's how persecutors, pursuers could do David's soul. Now that's impossible if it's an immortal essence within you. If it's some spirit essence within you, then that certainly is impossible. So he's likening Cush here to the lion that he himself took on when he was a young lad. And he remembers how this lion, when he was a shepherd, would tear animals, and how he defeated the lion with his bare hands with God's help. So now he looks back and remembers, as it was in those days with that lion, that's the way this wicked man is after David's soul, to try to tear it like a lion tears. Rending it in pieces while there's none to deliver. O eternal my God, if I've done this, if there be iniquity in my hands, there the Hebrew word is evil. It's not the same word as we'll read a little later, still translated iniquity, down in verse 14. This is a different word, even, in verse 14. But in the King James, you'd never know the difference unless you bothered to check it out and look up the original word. Congregation of the people compass you about. In other words, if you do this, then people will surround you and learn of you and see that you are a God that keeps what your judgments have been. And you'll back up your servant according to your judgments and your commandment. And then the congregation will just circle around you and recognize you and see you that you do what you say. For their sakes, therefore, return you on high. In other words, for the sake of all these people who are saying, hey, Alan, let's wait and see what God does. See, David says this, and Saul and Cush say this, so let's watch and see what God does. So David says, now for all these people's sake that are surrounding you, God, and seeing what you're going to do, then you've got to get back up on high and intervene and take action. The Eternal shall judge the people. And this is a different word from back up in verse 7. Verse 7 is actually talking about peoples, plural. And here he's just talking about individuals. God judges individuals. Judge me, O Eternal, as an example of one of the people, according to my righteousness, according to my integrity that is in me. Now, you know, how many times would we dare to pray like that? Judge me, O Eternal, according to my righteousness. Of course, that's what Hezekiah said when God added 15 years to his life. Judge me, O Eternal, according to mine integrity. So not only what I've done that's right, but the way I am, what's my being, my integrity of nature. So here again, David emphasizes two areas of right and wrong, not only what you do, but what you are. Oh, let the wickedness of the wicked, now here the word is resha, lawless. Oh, let the lawlessness of the lawless come to an end. So here he's not just using the word rea for evil or wicked, but he's using the word lawlessness. Oh, let the lawlessness of the lawless come to an end, but establish the just. Now notice the contrast between lawlessness and just. So if you don't abide by the law, you'll never know what's just. If you lean to your own ideas or opinions of justice, you'll never agree with God. For the righteous God, see, God isn't lawless, God isn't wicked, God is righteous. And the righteous God tries the hearts and reigns. Now here again you'll find two words that are mentioned quite often going through the Scripture. The hearts, of course that's your inward being, and the reins are the authorities in your life. What's your bosses? What are your dictates in your life? And what's your attitude? My defense, or shield, the word's translated other places, my shield or defense is of God, which saves the upright in heart. Now there again, this word is plural, so he's not just talking about himself here, but he's talking about everybody that's upright. God saves the upright in heart. God judges the righteous. So he's a righteous God, and he judges the righteous. And God is angry with the wicked every day. So when you think God is mild-mannered or long-suffering or patient, that's true. But when someone goes to the degree that they've gone the wrong way to the extent that they've now become bent in their very nature and warped in their very being, God is angry with those every day. If he turned not, in other words, if God didn't have patience and wait and long-suffering, he will whet his sword. He has bent his bow and made it ready. So God's about ready to show his anger with the wicked by intervening with the sword and the bow and putting an end to the wicked and the evil, which is what David was praying. Verse 9, let the wickedness of the wicked come to an end. And that's going to happen when God whets his sword and bends his bow and makes it ready. He has also prepared for him the instruments of death. So not just the bow and the sword, but other means of death. But notice again, the wicked aren't going to be burnt forever in a lake of fire. They're going to be dealt with the sword and the bow and instruments of death. He ordains his arrows against the persecutors. So God has already decreed that arrows are going to intervene for David and put an end to his persecutors. Behold, he travaileth with iniquity and has conceived mischief and brought forth falsehood. He made a pit and digged it, and has fallen into the ditch which he made. His mischief shall return upon his own head. Of course, here he's talking about the wicked from verse 9 coming to an end. So his own mischief is going to come back on his own head, and again he'll fall into the ditch he's dug, which is a proverb throughout the Bible. He that digs a pit shall fall into it, and Haman that built the gallows was hanged on it. His mischief shall return upon his own head. His violent dealing shall come down upon his own pate. And of course, that's just a word for the part of the smooth skull. The word plate is actually what this is an abbreviation from. I will praise the Eternal according to his righteousness. I will sing praise to the name of the Eternal Most High. And here the Hebrew word for God is Elyon, E-L-Y-O-N. Now you'll find that used quite a bit through the Psalms, 36 times in the Old Testament. This is the first time in the book of Psalms, but you'll see it a number of times. I just write it in the margin, so you know these different names for God, because you're going to find a number of different names for God in the Psalms we're going to cover here this evening, including El and Elyon. And of course, at the end of Psalm 7, this is to the chief musician, and then upon Gittith, and of course, here it's talking about a wine press or a symbol of the Feast of Tabernacles, dwelling in peace and having wine brewed with the crushing of grapes in the wine vat. So here it's showing the tie-in with the Feast of Tabernacles, when God gives victory over the enemy and the wicked are put out of circulation and God puts an end to the wicked, then there's going to be a Feast of Tabernacles. There will be peace and dwelling in safety, dwelling in booths again. Now, in Psalm 8, a Psalm of David, O Eternal, our Lord, how excellent is your name in all the earth. Now, you know, a lot of people would have you believe that the God of the Bible is just a Jewish God, and the God of the Old Testament is just an Israeli God, and the holy days are all just for the nation of Israel. The Sabbath wasn't a universal law, it was just for Israel. So they try to get around obeying God's law by trying to make God a localized God. So we're going to notice as we go through the book of Psalms whether that holds water or not. Now, notice here, he doesn't say, "How excellent is your name in all Judea." That isn't what he says. And he doesn't say, "How excellent is your name in all Israel." And the very names of God should teach us better than to think God is a God of the national covenant with Israel, because the name Elohim is the name of a family of gods, and it's a universal name of God. It's not associated just with a specific tribe. In fact, I think most of us realize when you start out in the book of Genesis, it starts out talking about Elohim, in the beginning Elohim. So that's showing there both those gods are there together in the beginning. So you have Elohim all the way down through the Sabbath, chapter 2. The heavens and the earth were finished on the seventh day. Elohim ended his work. So they're both gods who ended their work on the seventh day. And you know, it's kind of interesting to read commentaries trying to explain what verse 2 really means. They think it can't be the way it's written. They say, well, you know, that Hebrew must be inaccurate. Let's look at some other Arabic or some other language and see if we can't figure out why it doesn't say on the sixth day God ended his work. Because they don't want God ending his work on the seventh day. And yet that's what it says. You can't get around the Hebrew term there in verse 2. On the seventh day God ended his work. It didn't say by the seventh day it already ended it. Some try to make it say that. Some try to say the word seventh here in Arabic is really six, by just changing a letter or a vowel or so. Well, none of that's true. God did the kind of work on the seventh day. And what kind of work did God do on the seventh day? Well, Jesus tells you back in the New Testament when they accused him of breaking the Sabbath, and he said, look, my Father works hitherto on the Sabbath, so do I. So there's the right kind of work to do on the Sabbath. And some of that work God did do on the Sabbath. Mr. Armstrong's always said, God ended his work on the seventh day. So some of the work God did, he had to do on the seventh day. Now, he didn't do any physical creating on the seventh day. So what kind of work did he do on the seventh day? Well, he blessed the Sabbath and hallowed it and sanctified it and taught man. And God did work on the seventh day, but he did a spiritual work on the seventh day. He didn't do a physical work. Now, notice what happens, though. When you come into the account beginning in verse 4, you actually have a second segment of the book of Genesis beginning in verse 4, and this is just magnifying the introductory outline God gave in chapter 1. And that's the way the Bible's written. Many times you'll find the first part of a subject covered, God gives a summary outline like he did to the Ten Commandments. And then after he's given that summary outline, then he goes back and fills in details. That's done in first and second giving of the law. It's done in the Ten Commandments. It's done here. So after God gave you that introductory summary of what had taken place way back at the beginning on the seven days, now he's going to go back and fill in more details. These are the generations of the heavens and the earth when they were created in the day that, now notice verse 4, that the eternal Elohim made the earth and the heavens. So now he's zeroing in on a specific member of the Elohim family, the eternal member of the Elohim family. So you find the word Lord God on down. And quite totally through a number of chapters, it talks about the one member of the Elohim family that was doing the actual things that are described as being done. Now, when you come to the nation of Israel, and these people say, well, how are we going to know God sent you, Moses? And God said, well, you just tell them my name. I am that I am. Say that I am has sent you. And all of a sudden, God becomes the God of Israel, and he comes the God of Israel by that name. But before that, he was the God of creation. He was the God of man and the God of the world. And it wasn't by that covenant name of the God of Israel. But you know, people want to have you believe that all of those things back there in that Old Testament were just given to one nation, one group of people, one country. So we're going to knock that in the head every chance we get. And that's the chance here in Psalm 8. How excellent is your name in all the earth. That means everywhere. The whole earth. Who has set your glory above the heavens? Now, what does he mean by that? You have set your glory above the heavens. Does that just mean that God's throne is in the third heaven beyond the first and second heavens? That means that, that's for sure. But it also means there are spirit beings up there in the third heaven that are giving God glory and testifying to God's glory all the time. So all those spirit beings up in the third heaven are also bearing witness to God's glory above the heavens. Now he goes on in verse 2, out of the mouth of babes and sucklings have you ordained strength. Now what does he mean by that? Now that's quoted in Matthew 21 and verse 16, so we might notice the context there and see what it's saying. Matthew 21, beginning verse 10, when he was come into Jerusalem, all the city was moved, saying, who is this? The multitude said, this is Jesus, the prophet of Nazareth, of Galilee. Well, Jesus went into the temple of God, cast out all them that sold and bought in the temple, overthrew the tables of the money changers and the seats of them that sold doves, and he said to them, it's written, my house shall be called the house of prayer, but you have made it a den of thieves. And the blind and the lame came to him in the temple, and he healed them. And when the chief priests and the scribes saw the wonderful things that he did, and the children crying into the temple and saying, Hosanna to the Son of David, they were sore displeased, and said to him, hear you what these say? And Jesus said unto them, yea, have you never read out of the mouth of babes and sucklings? You perfected praise? So here you see one of the ways that that psalm is to be understood, that from the time children are babies, if they're taught about a creator and about a God, then their innocency just grows up knowing there's a super being, there's a creator, there's a God that made everything and that brought things to existence. So right here in the temple, there were children crying in the temple saying, Hosanna to the Son of David. And yet how many grown-ups believe that? How many older people believe that? And why didn't they believe it? They got corrupted in their own intellect or their own groups or their own teachings. Then they said, well, do you hear what these say? Well, then Jesus quotes that psalm. Now, if I were a Jew and I didn't want to have that Matthew explain what I read there, I might do what Sansino does. Out of the mouth of babes and sucklings, here's how he explains that. God has endowed the human being with a unique faculty of speech. The phrase, Genesis 2:7, man became a living soul, is translated by the Targum, man became a speaking spirit. That is, a rational being with the power of expressing thought. Reason was incapable of action without a word symbol, and the first moment of rationality must also have been the first beginning of interior language. When therefore we hear an infant's prattle, we have proof of the divine creative might. So you know, just by the fact that humans speak and animals don't, that's the way he explains this psalm. So you begin to see how a Jewish writer or scholar might get around a fulfillment connected with the Messiah, and even babes admitting that Hosanna to the Son of David. Well, you let the Bible interpret the Bible. You don't turn to the Targums and the Talmuds and all the other things. Going on here then, out of the mouth of babes and sucklings have you ordained strength. Now here the word ordained is appointed and not in the sense of ordaining deacons or elders. Now you stop and think about David when he was a lad. Was strength ordained in David's life and his mind even when he was a babe and a suckling? Well, maybe he's referring back to his own youth, because he's certainly an example of that reality. Now, you may be surprised how much your children might know about God and might understand when they're in church or when you read the Bible storybooks to them. And so that may be another way that this scripture actually is real. Out of the mouth of babes and sucklings, strength is appointed. And then he goes on, because of your enemies, adversaries or enemies, that you might still the adversaries or enemies and the avenger or revenger, when I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars, which you have established, that's a different Hebrew word that means they're there, period. They're there for good until your word that established them alters it. So this is not the same word as ordained up above. This is a much stronger word. God established the moon and the stars. David must have been meditating at night when he wrote this, because he skips over the sun and anything else, and he just talks about the moon and the stars that God put up there in their cycles and their laws that they're forced to abide by. So one way of knowing the universal God is by the harmony of the universe. When I consider your heavens, plural, the first one, the atmosphere, the second one, where the heavenly bodies are, the third one, out there where you're under those cherubim on the seat. When I consider your heavens, they're termed God's heavens. They belong to Him. The work of your fingers. Now, all the way through here, you'll find that God is a being like we are, because it talks about God's ear and God's hands and God's fingers and God's parts of His body, just like we have. So the heavens didn't evolve. They're the work of God's fingers. The moon and the stars have been decreed by an established law that's permanent. And when I realize those things, then I think, what is man? And here the word is Enosh. What is mortal man? Not the son of Adam, but what is mortal man? That you're mindful of him. Why would you have your mind so full of mortal man? And what is the son of Adam? And there the word man is the other word, Adam, one of the other words. So here you begin to notice the distinctions between the three different words for man. One just means mortal man, earthbound man, man of the dirt. And the other means descendant of Adam, that you visit him. Notice, not that you're just acquainted with him or that you're aware of him, but you visit him. You intervene and send angels down like you did with Daniel for Gabriel. You visit him by intervening for him or chastening him. For you have made him a little lower than the angels. Now here you really run into something, because the Hebrew word angels there is the word Elohim. It's not the word messenger, Moloch, like the word Malachi. You've made him a little lower than the gods. And you've crowned him with glory and honor. You've made him to have dominion over the works of your hands. So the things in earth that God is going to give man dominion over, God made with his hands. The heavens are the work of his fingers, a lot more minutely planned and designed. You have put all things under his feet. Now, of course, a great deal of this is all quoted in the first chapter of Hebrews. Now notice what all was put under man's feet. Man's number is six, so you're going to have six of them here, all sheep and oxen, yea, and the beasts of the field, the fowl of the air, and the fish of the sea, and whatever passes through the paths of the seas. So sure enough, God lists six when he's talking about all things that have been put under man's feet so far. But that's not what's going to be put under man's feet in the future. And that's why Paul in Hebrews says, we don't yet see all things put under man's feet. Only the things listed back here, the physical creation so far, has been put under man's feet, but not God's heavens. O eternal, our Adonim, as the Hebrew word there is, the L-O-R-D in capital letters. So the psalm ends exactly like it started. How excellent is your name in all the earth. So, you know, in a case like that, a verse that's repeated over again in the same psalm must be for emphasis, and it must be also for writing style and harmony and unity. And it shows that psalm is complete in itself. Starts off and ends exactly the same way. O Eternal, our Adonim, how excellent is your name in all the earth. Now, of course, here you have the subscription that should go at the end of Psalm 8, to the chief musician upon Mithlabin. Now, this is an interesting terminology, Mithlabin. It actually comes from a word meaning the death of the champion. And that is exactly what that psalm's all about. How is God going to do all of this for man? Well, by Christ's death. That's how, the death of the champion. Now, I might show you a parallel. 1 Samuel chapter 17. Here's the death of the champion. 1 Samuel 17. Now, the Philistines gathered together their armies to battle, were gathered together at Shochah, which belongs to Judah, and pitched between Shochah and Azekah in Ephesdamim. And Saul and the men of Israel were gathered together and pitched by the valley of Elah and set the battle in array against the Philistines. The Philistines stood on a mountain on the one side. Israel stood on a mountain on the other side. There was a valley between them. So when you've got two powers and a being between them, there went out a champion. And this Hebrew word is the very word we read back there in that psalm. Ish Habanayim, the man between the two, is what the word literally means. The champion is the one between the two that is going to be slain. So here you have the same Mithlabin, the death of the man between, the death of the champion. Of course, in this case it was Goliath, and of course David came out on the other side. So here you get the context or the meaning of the Psalm 8 by this subscription. And it doesn't fit the next psalm at all. So Psalm 9 starts out a psalm of David.